Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this December 2010 Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening's Science Wonders, Jim Campanella. Every few months or so, I get enough requests from listeners to be able to do an all-request episode. So, yes, this is it. My Christmas present to you guys, listener-requested stories. Let's get going. The first story of the night has been in the news for the last couple of weeks, and normally, because it has been done to death by both the science and non-science media, I would completely ignore it. Yes, I happen to be one of those people who loathe going along with the crowd. However, I have had several listeners who have requested I comment on the new arsenic-based bacteria that was discovered recently. Well, let me add my two cents to the many gold pieces that have already been strewn out there. If you've been living on the planet Zorkon for the last several weeks and missed this story, let me tell you about it. Dr. Felisa Wolf-Simon and her colleagues from the NASA Astrobiology Institute and the U.S. Geological Survey published a paper a couple of weeks ago in the journal Science describing a new bacteria that they had isolated that is unlike anything else on the face of the Earth. GFAJ1 was isolated from Mono Lake in eastern California. Mono Lake is a hypersaline alkaline water body with high dissolved arsenic concentrations, upwards of 200 micromolar, which is quite a bit of arsenic, with a pH of about 9. You don't expect anything to be living there because, well, there's a massive amount of salt, the pH is 9, and the amount of arsenic in there is so high it makes the Dead Sea look like the Great Barrier Reef in terms of the amount of life present. Now, biologists have had bacteria for years that can live in salt concentrations 100 times or more that of the ocean, high enough to be deadly to anything else. We call that category of bacteria halophiles because they love salt and can only live there. In general, we call these types of way-out strains extremophiles, meaning that they live under extreme conditions that nothing else can live under. At any rate, such bacterial extremophiles have been on the radar for the last several decades. What makes this new one so special? Well, GFAJ is special because it not only lives in extreme conditions, but it has completely altered its biochemistry to live under those conditions. When I say completely, I mean completely. Every other known organism on the face of the Earth uses phosphorus to do lots of important biochemical jobs. First and most important is that phosphorus is absolutely essential in making DNA. Not to get too far into it, but the bases in the DNA, which are the most famous part, GATC, are held together in the DNA strand structurally by a bunch of sugars called deoxyribose. These sugars themselves are held to one another by phosphates, creating one long chain. That has pretty much been an inviolable law of biology since we discovered it in the early 50s. GFAJ does not follow that inviolable law. It does not use phosphate because it is so scarce in Mono Lake. Instead, it uses arsenic, which to everything else is a deadly poison. Now, if you look at the periodic table, you will notice that phosphorus is right above arsenic in the same column. That means that at least chemically, they have the same number of bonding sites and can be exchanged for one another. If you remember the original Star Trek episode, Devil in the Dark, Kirk and company come across an organism that is based on silicon instead of carbon like Earth life. Again, that is theoretically possible because carbon and silicon are in the same column next to each other in the periodic table, and they have the same number of potential bonds. Carbon is such a good basis for life because it can make long, complex chains that can do all sorts of biological jobs. Silicon can make equally complex chains. Just ask any geologist and they will tell you that silicates are some of the most ubiquitous and complex rock molecules on the face of the Earth. Anyway, GFAJ has completely replaced phosphorus for a deadly poison, and its DNA is arsenated, not phosphorylated. What are the implications of this? Well, first, the most obvious implication is that it expands our view of what is possible. We had a much more narrow definition of life before, but now we can see that life may exist in conditions that we had not previously anticipated, like a place with no phosphates. Obviously, lots of people are thrilled because it bolsters the possibility of life on other planets. The second implication is that the entire biochemistry of GFAJ is going to be ass backwards from anything we've ever seen. Phosphorus is not just used in making DNA, it's used in making ATP, adenosine triphosphate. That is like the dollar or the euro in terms of energy currency in a cell, Presumably, GFAJ does not make ATP because it makes ATA, adenosine triarsenate. That completely blows my mind and opens up a whole new area of biochemical study just by itself. It's not just molecules like ATP which are modified, but a whole series of others, especially in the energetic pathways of this thing. The third implication is that every other organism on the face of the Earth uses phosphorylation as part of signaling pathways, that is, turning proteins on and off after they are made. This has pretty much been universal as far as a system of post-translational, that is, protein regulation. Well, all bets are off with GFAJ because there is no phosphorus available, presumably. It arsenates proteins as a post-translational modification. Now, I'm guessing this. It hasn't been shown yet. But again, this would be different from anything known. And it does follow. It makes sense. I mean, if the phosphorus isn't there, it would have to do this. The next implication is my favorite since it is so bizarre from reading the paper in Science. It is not even clear if the researchers tested this or not. Arsenic is poisonous to every other form of life on Earth except GFAJ because it competes with phosphorus. Since phosphorus plays a major role in energy production of cells, that means that cells die when arsenic replaces phosphorus. The corollary to that idea should be that GAFJ does not use phosphorus, it uses arsenic, so phosphorus should be toxic to GAFJ. That makes sense. Phosphorus would compete with arsenic and replace it, again, creating a toxic situation. But creating the mirror image of that situation for every other organism that we know of, it's almost disturbing. Number five, you would think that a bacteria like this kind comes from out of nowhere and can't be related to anything else on the face of the Earth, but that's not the case. The paper generates a beautiful family tree for GFJ based on its DNA sequence and comparing it to other bacteria. The family tree clearly shows that GFAJ is an extremophile, which is closely related to halobacteria. That makes sense since this new bacteria, in addition to being so strange in its use of arsenic, also is a halophile, since Mono Lake has such a high salt concentration. It is, however, unclear from the simple phylogenetic tree that I saw whether GFAJ is an antecedent of those other normal halophiles or descendant of them. This is cool. But some scientists have been quick, too quick in my opinion, to suggest that perhaps early life was based on arsenic and not phosphorus because phosphorus was rare in the beginning. But there is little or no evidence for that, especially since they came up with the hypothesis several weeks ago for the first time. The final upshot implication of all of this is that an army of biochemists, physiologists, molecular biologists, and microbiologists will be able to make their careers on just the study of this new and amazing bacteria. Why? Well, because it breaks all the rules that have already been set up. We don't have to quite start from scratch with GFAJ since we have more than a century of hard biochemical understanding of standard Terran biology behind us. It's not like this thing is from Mars. But it will take years to fill in the gaps and try to figure out all the new rules that it functions under. Let me just finish this segment with a caveat. All the stuff that I just told you may be complete nonsense. There's already a controversy brewing suggesting that all this arsenic stuff is just bad science. Several biologists have pointed out that the selection process for the bacteria is flawed. I didn't mention this, but in order to isolate any bacteria to purity, you have to go through a selection and enrichment process. Well, some people have pointed out that the process in this case included phosphorus. In other words, phosphorus was fed to GAFJ and didn't appear to poison it. In fact, the bacteria seems to use it physiologically. It may be that arsenic is only a backup plan for the organism and not a primary pathway, which would invalidate many of the conclusions being drawn. Also, there are no chemical structures yet showing without doubt evidence that only arsenic is in the DNA, etc., of this organism. At this point, we are all just hoping that this discovery does not go the way of cold fusion and simply disappear. The second story of the night was a request from Jesse Willis, editor of the very fine science fiction and fantasy audio website. Given all the doom and gloom I have professed about plastics and store receipts for the last few months, Jesse wanted to know what the latest info was on the safety of sucralose, the sweetener better known by its market name of Splenda. Well, first, Let me point out that for a percentage of the population, Splenda is not that fantastic. In about 35 to 40% of people who ingest sucralose in large amounts, there is the major drawback that it causes severe intestinal gas, intestinal distress, and diarrhea. Since such sufferers are in the minority and it is not a deadly effect, the FDA does not even bother with a warning label on sugar-free ice cream or drinks, or whatever is flavored with your sucralose. But does Splenda have any serious and long-term health problems associated with it? Well, apparently it's fairly safe. And no, I'm not just making that statement cavalierly. There are several recent papers that actually support that point of view. First is a paper in the July 2010 issue of the journal Food and Chemical Toxicity. It was written by a disparate group of researchers from industry and academia. The PI seems to be someone named Dr. Brusick from a company called Toxicology Consultants in, and I swear this is true, Bumpus, Virginia. The title of the paper is The Absence of Genotoxicity of Sucralose. That means they were trying to determine whether Splenda causes cancer or at the very least genetic mutations. So what did they find? Their myriad studies included the Ames reverse mutation test. This is a standard test to determine how often a mutated bacteria remutates back to normal when treated with a test compound and a control compound. In this case, the control and Splenda showed no statistical differences in inducing mutations. Because you cannot trust experiments done with bacteria when you're worried about higher organisms, they also did a reverse mutation test with mouse lymphoma cells, in which they pretty much did the same thing as with the bacterial cells. They tested to see how often reverse mutations occurred in the mouse cells. Again, the results were negative. They also tested for in vitro chromosome damage in human lymphocytes, and again, this was done in culture with live cells, but not in whole animals. And again, the results were negative. No damage to DNA with Splenda above normal background. Finally, to be complete, they did an in vivo chromosome aberration test in rats and mice. And again, all the results were evaluated as negative. In all, these results support the overall conclusion already made by regulatory and health agencies that sucralose is safe for its intended use. A second 2010 paper from the International Journal of Morphology suggests that Splenda may not be quite so safe for expectant mothers. Dr. Ademir Rodeo and company from the School of Medicine at São José de Rio Preto, Brazil, wrote an article entitled Effects of Sucralose Ingestion on Fetal and Placental Weights and Umbilical Cord Length. Very straightforwardly, since very few fetal studies had been done on Splenda, Rodeo decided to estimate the fetal and placental weights and umbilical cord length in fetuses from pregnant female rats after ingestion and non-ingestion of sucralose. In the treated group, 5 pregnant female rats, sucralose was administered at a dose of about 30 milligrams per kilogram per day from the 10th to 14th day of pregnancy. In the control group, same number of female rats, saline solution was administered at the same dose and by the same route. On the 20th day of gestation, both groups were sacrificed for weighing of the fetuses and placentas and measurement of umbilical cord length. The mean values of fetal weight and umbilical cord length of the treated group were statistically lower than controls. However, placental weight did not differ statistically between the treated and control groups. It can be concluded from that work that sucralose ingestion at 30 milligrams per kilogram per day from days 10 to 14 in pregnancy diminished fetal weight and umbilical cord length, which suggests that it must be getting across the placental membrane. Okay, so that is not such a great result for pregnant women trying to watch their diets with Splenda. But on the other hand, we're talking about rats here, not humans. More on that a little later. One last Splenda story. Many neurobiologists in the last couple of years have started to question the use of any artificial sweeteners in human diets. Most recently, in the Yale Journal of Biology and Medicine, neuroscientist Dr. King Yang of Yale University makes a pretty strong case that artificial sweeteners have actually been making the world fatter. Yang shows a clear statistical rise in the percentage of the population who are obese, and that rise coincides exactly with an increase in the widespread use of non-caloric artificial sweeteners, such as aspartame in Diet Coke, or sucralose in Pepsi One. Yang examines the development of artificial sweeteners in a historic context. He then summarizes the epidemiological and experimental evidence concerning their effects on weight. And finally, he attempts to explain those effects in light of neurobiology, of food reward. Historically, Yang is in good company, going all the way back to the 1980s. The big study that was done then was the San Antonio Heart Study. It examined 3,682 adults over a 7 to 8 year period in the 1980s. When matched for initial body mass index, gender, ethnicity, and diet, drinkers of artificially sweetened beverages consistently had higher BMIs at the follow-up, with dose dependence on the amount of consumption. So what does Yang conclude? Yang says that increasing evidence suggests that artificial sweeteners do not activate the neural food reward pathways of the brain in the same fashion as natural sweeteners. Lack of caloric contribution generally eliminates what he calls the post-ingestive component, which is basically turning on any kind of satiation in the brain after eating. Functional magnetic imaging of the brain in normal weight men showed that glucose ingestion resulted in a prolonged signal depression in the hypothalamus. That is presumably what leads to satiation and a stoppage in eating. Yang found that that response was not observed when sucralose was ingested. I guess the upshot is that no matter what artificial sweetener you're eating, and whether it does appear to be safe, we need to be very careful with how we employ those foods. I want to close this section with a story about rats and sweeteners. You may not know this story. I'm not sure that many people know it. In fact, a good friend of mine who teaches high school biology and is quite well informed was surprised when I told this to her. It is the saccharin story. Saccharin is the oldest artificial sweetener and was discovered by Constantine Fallberg at Johns Hopkins University in 1879 while he was working on coal tar derivatives. Yum yum. Decades after its debut, saccharin remained a specialty product for diabetics on store shelves. A sugar shortage during World War II and a shift in aesthetics toward favoring a thin figure encouraged women to turn to artificial substitutes as well. Around that time, the wording on diet soda bottles was subtly changed from, quote, for use only in people who must limit sugar intake, unquote, to, quote, for use in people who wish to limit sugar intake, unquote. In 1969, saccharin was found to cause bladder cancer in rats. In the typical government fashion, it took the FDA another 8 years to announce its intention to ban saccharin in 1977. Amazingly, avid consumers protested. That led to the U.S. Congress ordering the FDA not to enforce the final ban. A warning label, like we have on cigarettes nowadays, was nonetheless required on all saccharin products. It was finally found in the 1990s that bladder cancer associated with saccharin ingestion was specific to rodent physiology. Humans could not get it. So saccharin, despite being unsafe for rats and mice, was safe for humans. The saccharin warning label was removed in 2000, and lots of people never even noticed the warning label was removed, including my friend the high school teacher. What's the moral to the story? Be very careful when listening to what science has to say about artificial food. Just because it appears to be safe, it may not be. And just because it appears to be dangerous, it may not be. We just have to take things with a grain of salt and wait long enough to see how safe they really are. Food safety, in some sense, is a waiting game. You wait long enough, and the true story finally comes out. The next story was pointed out to me by Tom Allerts. Again, forgive my pronunciation of your name, Tom. I'm hoping that since you didn't correct me after last month, I guess I can't be too far off. Tom pointed out an amazing story about the apparent rediscovery of some pretty well-known science by a group of physicians. First of all, let me tell you, I've been teaching pre-meds going on 15 years now, and I hate to generalize, but too many of them have the same mental traits, especially the successful ones. And unfortunately, the way that most college teaching is done does not help them break their bad habits. What bad habits am I talking about? Well, the worst of those habits is a tendency to be very short-sighted when it comes to studying for exams and actually learning information. An example, I remember that one of my very best students ever, who did go on to medical school, aced my cell and molecular biology class. He easily got an A in it. He then took, the following semester, my genetics class. I remember asking him a simple molecular biology question in class, in that genetics class, having to do with material he had learned the semester before. Now, we are talking 2 months previously, and he had gotten like a 97 or something on the exam covering the same topic. But he gave me a blank stare as if he had never heard of any such thing before. What am I getting at? I will be blunt. Pre-meds, even the very smart ones, study for an exam, cram all that material into their short-term memory, and then it is gone. If it was not actually gone, they would not spend thousands of dollars on Kaplan-type courses that teach them how to take the U.S. medical school entrance exams and basically reteach themselves all the material they should have learned originally in their first few years of chemistry and biology classes. That, by the way, is why the undergrad pre-meds generally fear me and avoid my classes. I test concepts and understanding in my exams, not just rote memorization, which they have been programmed to employ over the years. So what does this have to do with Tom's story? Tom pointed me to a blog story by the Flip Tomato, quote-unquote, who is a postgraduate expatriate physics student. The Tomato had a link to a journal story that had me laughing until I almost fell down. I think my wife thought I was having a seizure until I told her the story. My wife was a math major in college, so she laughed almost as much as I did when I told her. What is the story? It was published in a recent issue of the journal Diabetes Care and entitled, quote, "A Mathematical Model for the Determination of Total Area Under Glucose Tolerance and Other Metabolic Curves," unquote. At this point, before I go any farther, any math person should be making Scooby-Doo noises like, The story was written by Dr. M.M. Tai, M.D. of St. Luke's Hospital in New York City, and here is the objective statement from the paper by old Doc Tai. Quote, "To develop a mathematical model for the determination of total areas under curves from various metabolic studies. In Tai's model, the total area under a curve is computed by dividing the area under the curve between two designated values on the x-axis into small segments, rectangles and triangles, whose areas can be accurately calculated from their respective geometrical formulas." Unquote. Okay, if you took lots of science in high school and college, you have probably already picked up on the horror that is Tai's model. I can barely say Tai's model, by the way, without laughing aloud. For those of you who are not forced to take too much math, let me just be blunt. Dr. Tai has rediscovered calculus. Calculus was discovered independently by Isaac Newton and Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz back in the late 1600s, so it has been around a hell of a long time. As Flip Tomato, the physicist, points out, Tai has more specifically rediscovered the trapezoidal rule for approximating the integral, which is how you determine the area under any curve. Tai concludes his paper with, quote, "Tai's model proves to be able to 1. Determine total area under a curve with precision, 2. Calculate area with varied shapes that may or may not intercept on one or both xy axes, 3. Estimate total area under a curve plotted against varied time intervals, whereas other formulas only allow the same interval, and 4. Compare total areas of metabolic curves produced by different studies." Unquote. To top off the story, other medical journal articles have already referenced Tai's paper 75 times. That means there are at least 75 other doctors who have forgotten the calculus that they were forced to learn as pre-meds. Why do I find this no surprise at all? Now do you see why I have gained my hard-nosed reputation and why I'm so difficult on pre-meds? I actually want them to learn and remember the material I teach them. Whatever university that Dr. Tai went to as an undergraduate student should consider taking back his liberal arts degree. But hey, let's not forget, he is obviously a very smart guy. After all, he rediscovered an entire branch of mathematics. And how many people can say that? The final story of the night was suggested by one of my own graduate students and an avid listener, C.J. Urso. He suggested that I look into any real astronomy or astrogeology stories dealing with the end of the world predicted to occur in 2012. I have to admit, when I heard this request, all I could think about was that lousy movie from last year. Yes, The Eponymous 2012. It was simply horrible, with no basis in any form of scientific reality that I can think of. As BBC movie reviewer Mark Kermode put it, quote, Roland Emmerich's 2012 is like apocalyptic porn. It revels in destruction, unquote. 2012 is supposed to bring the sun into the final position of its 26,000-year cycle to line up directly between the Earth and the center of the galaxy. No one knows the perils that will manifest at that moment, but one thing is known. It will occur in 2012. We can't really say how it'll affect us. The lineup may affect gravity, which will in turn affect ocean tides. The lineup could affect the magnetosphere by weakening it or even reversing its polarity. Or even it could cause the production of solar flares. That's another concern that could grow out of excessive gravity wells. Is any of this likely? That's first. And second, how in the heck would ancient Mayans predict this? Is moving past the ecliptic and lining up with that black hole at the center of our galaxy going to destroy the Earth? Not bloody likely, in my opinion, and apparently it's not just my opinion. I did a long and extensive search on several different scientific journal databases, and could not find one, not one, serious scientist who was addressing this as a grave issue as far as writing serious journal articles. What does that tell you? To me, it says that if the end is coming, that it will be one hell of a surprise to most of the scientists on the planet who are not crackpots, nutcases, or charlatans trying to make a fast buck by selling schlock science books to the public. All right, let's make this clear. Earth will not pass the galactic ecliptic in 2012. The solar system passes through the ecliptic every 30 million years. Dr. John Bacall of Princeton published an article in 1985 in Nature that explained in very clear mathematical analysis that the movement of the sun is perpendicular to the galactic plane, and it takes a very long time to pass that plane. And the last time that we went through it was 3 million years ago. That means that the Earth is moving away from the galactic plane and won't be due to cross it for another 30 million years. In addition, the margin of error in these calculations is at least 2.1 parsecs, or about 6.5 light years. So that supposed alignment that people are talking about, that is never going to happen. A more recent article in 2007 in the journal Astrophysics by Dr. Yogesh Joshi of Queen's University in Belfast again calculated the displacement of the sun from the galactic plane and found the very same result as the article from 1985. So how did the crazies come to their conclusions? Well, it seems to be a serious misinterpretation over what exactly is happening in 2012 from an astronomic standpoint. The event that will take place in 2012 is only significant from the Earth's point of view. The precession cycle, or the 26,000-year wobble of the Earth, only causes the effect of the stars changing positions on the horizon, and therefore on the effect of galactic alignment. If you were viewing this precession from anywhere else in the solar system, it would be completely and totally insignificant. There's no gravitational force or radiation to be expected from this event, because other than the tilt of the Earth, nothing will be any different than the last few thousand solstices. And as such, Earth will be no closer to the galactic center than any other solstice. In fact, it'll be farther away from the galactic center than the Mayans were at that time. Then, there are the theories that there is a hidden planet X out there that will come into alignment with the Earth in December 2012. Again, this is just plain nonsense. Several hundred years of astronomic observation in our solar system has demonstrated no hidden planets. A hidden planet here would be even more obvious than an exoplanet 30 light years away. Imagine the interplanetary wobble it would induce even with a massive orbit. What about pole reversal? Would it be catastrophic? Well, magnetic shifts in the poles do take place. Both magnetic pole shifts and physical pole shifts do take place. And in fact, we're in the middle of a long process of magnetic pole shifting, the biggest effect of which is that we're going to have to realign our compasses in a few hundred years. Here's an excerpt from an article from NASA. Quote, reversals take a few thousand years to complete, and during that time, contrary to popular belief, the magnetic fields do not vanish. It just gets more complicated. Magnetic lines of force near the Earth's surface become twisted and tangled, and magnetic poles pop up in unaccustomed places. A south magnetic pole might emerge over Africa, for instance, or a north magnetic pole over Tahiti. It's strange, but it's still a planetary magnetic field, and it still protects us from space radiation and solar storms, unquote. The other kind of pole shift is a physical pole shift. Now, this would require a tremendous amount of energy to induce, and that is not part of any cycle or natural occurrence, and no increasing of solar energy could be cause for it. We've actually had a few degree shifts of the poles in the past, but not a reversal by any means. Dr. William Sager of Texas A&M says, quote, "Our data set indicates that physical pole shifts take place at a rate between 5 and 10 degrees per every million years. Essentially, it happens within the blink of an eye in terms of geological time," unquote. What this is saying is those crazies who call this event fast, call 5 to 10 million years fast, and are predicting a specific date for this to happen, are just plain ridiculous. And that the Mayans had anything to do with predicting this is just plain absurd. Now, I could be wrong about this, but I guess only time will tell. Let's see if there is a January 2013 issue of Science News. Check back here in 2 years and we'll know if the world has ended or not. By the way, the announcement has come out for a 2012 sequel, I swear to God. Again, directed by Roland Emmerich. I can't wait to see that one. I mean, what exactly do you do as far as a plot is concerned about the time after the end of the world? Anyway, that's all for me from now. As always, take care. Don't drink Pepsi One if you're pregnant. Keep an eye out for Planet X. Merry Christmas, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.